Yes. What's next for Team Zsu?
Well, that was only part one. It's a cliffhanger. Now I'm going to go hunt down that shark, or whatever it is, and hopefully kill it. I don't know how yet. Maybe dynamite.
You don't know what it is?
No, I've never seen anything like it before in my life.
You say this is a jaguar shark. That's the title of your film.
It was coming right at us. I just said the first two words that came into my head.
C'est une espèce en voie de disparition. Pourquoi vouloir la tuer?
That's an endangered species at most. What would be the scientific purpose of killing it?
Revenge.
Okay, and are you ready for the show?
Yay, we're ready, Lucy. Please start.
And so I started.
Hey, everybody, this is Kevin Farley, and you're listening to the Homemade Broadcast. Homemade biscuits, homemade broadcast.
Broadcast.
Personnel, this is CBTS. Space vehicle pre-count operations will start on my mark at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
It is the Homemade Broadcast, HMB Radio on RadioSt.Pete.com. I am your host, Will Kuntz. So happy and lucky and blessed to be back with you again. I hope you're having a great week, had a great week, a great weekend, a great start to your week, depending on when you're listening to this program. And thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe. You can subscribe to this show or wherever you get your podcasts. And always listen on HMBRadio.com. Just search HMB Radio. Easy as that. Hotel Mike Bravo Radio. And then it'll come up. You subscribe. You know, you maybe while you're there, you give a 5-star rating. You know, it only takes a second. Really helps us out. So don't forget we got stickers available too. HMB Radio stickers. I keep putting them out where my guest sits and they never take them. And I don't know if it's because they're like, I don't want this. Or they're just like, oh, this must not be for me. And I forget to remind them all the time. But I do have stickers that I will send you for free. Just email thehomemadebroadcast@radiosaintpete.com. Provide me with your mailing address, and I will put some in the mail for you. This week on the show, we have Ben Montgomery. He's a writer for the Tampa Bay Times. I saw or heard him on the Radio Lab podcast, which I'm a big fan of. And he had a story about police shootings. So we talk about that and what he found while collecting this data over a period of 3 years. So he's a great guest. Thank you to everybody that came out to the Hollander Hotel this past weekend for the, what do we call it, Poolside Comedy Jam. Thank you, Zach, Rio, Joey, and John for performing to that. It was unique. It was outside. It was during the day. You don't see comedy by a pool very often, but the guys did great, managed to pull it off fine. I'm not sure if we'll be welcome back. There were some tense moments there for a little while. I actually emailed the Hollander person or Facebook messaged them and asked if they got any feedback because I know it was tense there, especially towards the end, and she has not replied. So I don't know if there's going to be another one at the Hollander, but, you know, we'll see. We raised a lot of money, like $400 for Pet Pal. So for a little show like us, that's a big deal. So thank you to everybody who participated. Thank you to those who came out. We hope we'll do it again soon. I don't know. We'll see. So this week, yes, we have Ben Montgomery on the show. Make sure you follow us on social media, facebook.com/HMB Radio and on Twitter at @home_made_man. Follow Radio St. Pete. Just Radio St. Pete. RadioSt.Pete, all one thing. You can find it on Facebook, you know, Twitter. We're doing Instagram now as well. So find us on there. Let's follow, see what's going on with the shows here. All right, let's get to it. This week, Ben Montgomery, Tampa Bay Times, talking. We're keeping it light this week with police shootings. Ben Montgomery, welcome to the Homemade Broadcast.
Hey, thanks a lot. Good to be here.
You look startled.
No, that intro caught me off guard. I'm glad to be here, though.
Yeah, I do a little bit of, I don't really edit, But I do my little intro at the beginning, so you don't have to suffer through my thoughts for the week.
Fantastic. So we just what jump are your right thoughts into for the week?
Well, this week, and you seem like a guy who might know about this. I'm trying to. I'm cheap, and I'm going on a cruise in a few weeks. So I'm doing the mouthwash trick. Are you familiar with this?
No, I don't know this.
You dump out mouthwash bottles, and then you fill it with vodka, put some green food coloring in it. Boom. Who needs a drink package at this point?
Because you're not allowed to take booze on a cruise. I've never been on a cruise.
Really?
Know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you can't. No booze on a cruise. You can take one bottle of wine,
and that's it. Wow.
Yeah. So
I thought you paid for a cruise up front, and then you got to drink for free for a week.
Well, they have these things called drink packages.
Uh-huh.
But the thing with that's the drink extra. Packages is, yes, it's extra, and you get cut off after 14, which that's plenty. Wow. Don't get me wrong here. But
14 a day?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But I have a feeling that they water down the actual, when they're making you drinks.
Oh, I'm sure of it.
Because I've had 14 in a day and been fine.
Yeah.
And if I had 14 at my house, I'd be on the ground.
Right.
So that's why we're doing this, me and my buddies. But you can't get the smell out of there, out of the plastic. So I'm trying to figure out ways to get the smell out. I got 2 weeks. And
oh, you mean the smell of the mouthwash?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
so it's not like they're opening your mouthwash bottle and smelling to make sure it's not vodka.
No, I got it all planned out. I kept the labels and everything. I'm going to tape the childproof where you peel it to open it up and everything. I got it all. It works.
How many mouthwash bottles are you going to take?
We're going to bring 4 mouthwash bottles. And they're a decent size. I mean, I'm pretty sure they know about this. Like, I'm not the first person to figure this out. There's like videos on YouTube about
how to do it. Yeah.
It's you would think that Googling how to get smell out of mouthwash bottles by now would come up with some results. Surprisingly not. So I think I'm going to try baking soda, and if that doesn't work, charcoal powder.
Oh, it sounds like like noble work.
Yes.
Definitely.
just because I'm cheap and we're all kind of cheap. But
I totally hear it. The only thing I know about cruise ships is from a story I did for the Times. Goodness, it must be 4 or 5 years ago. Somebody, evidently the cruise liner coming into port here, somebody had fallen off, and it just prompted this, intense curiosity. Like, what does it take to fall off a cruise ship?
Yeah.
And so I talked to a bunch of people who'd been on cruises and who knew about cruise ships and safety types and whatnot. And it's actually, like, really hard to fall off a cruise ship. But if you've drank a full bottle of mouthwash bottle of vodka, maybe that ups your chances at falling off a cruise ship a little bit.
We could probably – I wonder what your chances of survival is if you fall off. Probably not good, I would imagine.
Oh, I doubt it. I think they keep going. What are they going to stop at,
Yeah, I mean, how would they know?
Football field-sized boat to pick you up? I don't think so.
Right. And you're probably in the middle of the ocean too. You're it's not looking good for you.
And you use the mouthwash bottle as a flotation device.
Yes, right. It'll be empty because you drank it all, so it'll be good to go. Yeah. Well, you do write for the Tampa Bay Times. How did you get involved with them? Kind of introduce yourself to the audience here.
Yeah, sure. So I wanted to be a farmer when I was in college, and at Arkansas Tech University, the Harvard of West Central Arkansas, as we fondly refer to it.
The Mountain Goats, right?
The Wonder Boys.
Okay.
Yeah, and your listeners won't see this, but I'm revealing that I am a tried and true Wonder Boy for life.
You certainly are.
Some ink.
Nice little tattoo there.
Yeah. And then I proposed to a girl, and she said, I'll marry you, but I don't want to be a farmer's wife. And so I needed a new line of work, and found one in writing. I never liked writing before that, but I thought, this is a good way to make a living. And so I started doing it then and bounced around from newspapers in Arkansas to Texas to upstate New York. And about 11 years ago, came down here to work for the Times.
She didn't want to be a farmer's wife. Aren't farmers rich? Like, a lot of them are really rich.
Loaded, yeah.
Way more than, no offense, but writers, there's not a lot of money in writing.
Right. Yeah. No. She wanted to get to New York, and I think that's
a better outlet. Then.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did that. We lived upstate for 5 years before coming down here. So she got that out of her system, and yeah. And we just celebrated 19 years in January.
Oh wow! Still with her. Right on.
Yeah. 3 little kids and pretty good life.
Yeah. Right on. So is the Times kind of like you're gonna stay here? I mean you. At this point?
Yeah, I mean, long ago, really, so right around the time I got into this business after college, you know, it became clear to me that the reputation of the Times and the industry was that it was a writer's paper, that it was a place that valued good journalism. You know, it has a unique ownership structure. It's not corporate owned. It's owned by the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. And so the mission is really kind of to not increase shareholder profit, but to like support democracy. And I liked that idea. I still like that idea. I think, I have one of the best jobs in the industry, and it would take a lot to dislodge me from the Tampa Bay Times. Yeah. Not just because the lifestyle here is great, but because that paper really, you know, it's never a burden to go into work. It's always, you know, what can I do today?
Right. And they're always taking home Pulitzers. I mean, every year, like the past couple of years, they're taking home one, right?
Yeah, I think they've won 12 so far. And it's because they, you know, by and large, if you've got a good idea and you want to pursue it and it's worthwhile, they green light, you know, they green light it. And this project I've done is, you know, a shining example of that.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's how I'm a big fan of the Radiolab podcast.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, working with Ben from the Tampa Bay Times. I'm like, I live in Tampa. I wonder what this is. So I looked you up and sent you a message, and you were nice enough to agree to come on here. But tell us about the piece and the podcast.
Yeah, so after the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which everybody knows about, in 2014, I came in contact for the very first time that I know of with the idea that we don't keep stats on police shootings. And there was a lot of hand-wringing in the press because nobody could say how many times citizens got shot by police in the country. And I thought, well, maybe that's different in Florida, and started doing some research, and it turns out, no, nobody could say how many times police shoot citizens in Florida. And so it occurred to me that these things that we respond to, the viral videos that everybody watches of police shooting people, our reaction is solely to the anecdote. And we can't even say, is this part of a trend? Are shootings of citizens on the uptick? Are we should we be looking for ways to change the way in which we police because there's an uptick in these shootings? You know, we can't answer any of that without the data. And so and this is a state where I can tell you how many purse snatchings with a couple of, you know, clicks around on the web. I can tell you how many purse snatchings there were in 2006. Mm. Like, you can get that finite with that specific with the data, but not police shootings. And I was just kind of outraged by that. And I ranted about it in a staff meeting. And long story short, you know, my boss was like, let's find out. And so that launched us on what's been now almost 3 years of work to account for police shootings in Florida.
So where do you start with that when you're trying just to track down these incidents involving police? What do you do?
I had no idea at the time how many police agencies, how many law enforcement agencies there were in the state of Florida. And so it started with that very basic research. And it turns out the Florida Department of Law Enforcement keeps a list of every police agency in the state of Florida, and there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 388. And so, you know, Florida enjoys some pretty great public records laws.
When you say 388, does that include, like, sheriff's office, individual municipalities pretty much? Like,
yeah, 62 sheriff's offices, one for every county in Florida. And then every, you know, just about every incorporated municipality in the state has a police force. From, you know, tiny forces with two or three officers to huge forces with, you know, 1,500 officers, like Miami-Dade Police Department. So airports sometimes have their own police force. College campuses,
right,
have
right.
their own police force. So so we got and compiled a list of every police force in the state and contact information for every head of those sheriff's offices and police departments, and ultimately sent him a records request in September. It was actually 9/11, September 11th of 2014. I emailed every sheriff and police chief in the state asking for at the time, 5 years of records, starting in January 1st, 2009, to that point, which was September 14, any time an officer fired a weapon and somebody was injured or killed by the bullet, give me any paper, any report generated by those incidents. And they started coming in, responsive documents. Sometimes they were, you know, because there's no centralized record-keeping system or no uniform record-keeping system, a lot of times it was just an email from, you know, from the sheriff, especially in small counties, from the sheriff saying, well, we, you know, we've only had one, and it was Officer Davis, and here is a press clipping about this shooting. And that, for instance, would be used to try to satisfy our request. But we were interested in going deeper than that. And did you do an internal affairs investigation? Did you do, you know, was there a use of force report? Was there evidence submitted? All of this. So we were interested in all of it with the idea of ultimately, like, building a database that would have useful information in it.
Is that something that they have to respond to under, like, freedom of information, where they have to give this information to you, or were there some that just didn't weren't cooperative?
Yeah, in Florida, it all falls under state statute 119, Chapter 119, and that pretty much lays out the idea that any document created in the by a government employee in the conduct of government business, with a few exceptions, should be available for inspection by any member of the general public. And so, very simply, that great umbrella law gives you and I, and anybody who wants to, the ability to request these documents and to have the opportunity to review these documents. So, you know, on a federal level, it's called the Freedom of Information Act. On the local level, it's Chapter 119, but that's essentially it. We asked for these documents, and some agencies were very quick to respond, especially the big agencies that deal with the media a lot and deal with records requests a lot, very quick to respond. You know, some of them it took a couple of days, and they shot it back. Others, it was months of work. In fact, I made that request in September of 14, and the last three reports I got from Homestead, the Homestead Police Department, were Monday of this week. So,
Oh, wow. So
some of them, it took a long time to, you know, to fulfill our request. It just takes constant haggling, and, you know, they're clearly in violation of the law. But they need to be, you know, some of the agencies need to be reminded of that. And so, you know, it just means being stern on the telephone a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what did you find out from all this research? It took you 3 years. You put out this story a little while ago. What was the info?
Yeah. Well, top-line findings, 827 people at least were shot in that six-year period, January 1st, 2014. I'm sorry, 2009 to December 31st, 2014, which is roughly one person every 2.5 days in the state of Florida. And you got to remember, the state of Florida is 20 million people, the third largest state in the country, with somewhere over 100 million visitors a year. So it's a small percentage of people who live here and who visit here who are actually shot by police. But inside of those findings of 827, more than half were fatal shootings. Inside of those findings, we got really specific. We learned that, you know, about 20% of everybody shot by police in that period were known to be mentally ill, and we're not guessing at that. That means so that's got to be a conservative number. It means somebody in the writing the police report, or a witness or a family member of the person shot by police, reported specifically that they had been diagnosed with a mental illness. So that seems like a big number. You know, demographics-wise, 40% of people shot by police were black. And that is certainly out of whack with the black population in Florida, which numbers around 15%.
Yeah, I got 2005, 17%. That was the 2005 census, so.
Yeah, it's a little lower, yeah. So inside of that number, it turns out you're far more likely to be shot by police if you're black, if you're unarmed, during a traffic stop, if you're in the engaged in the commission of a minor crime, like shoplifting or something of that nature, or if you're trying to run away. Mm-hmm. And so there's some pretty interesting findings, I think. You know, perhaps it's something that, you know, I won't deny, I like had a hunch that that was the case. But to see the numbers for the very first time that like show this without a doubt, you know, is a bit shocking.
Why do you think this is happening at a higher rate for blacks?
That's not really my job to think. I mean, I think if you let me correct that. It is my job to think. It's not my job to make guesses at why. I think it has to do with a lot of societal factors, and the experts will tell you a lot of times police target minority neighborhoods, which tend to be quote-unquote high-crime areas. It's often the case that there is an ingrained, perhaps even subconscious, a bias among police, whether known or not, whether spoken or unspoken, about about perceptions in the black community, and that if you talk to experts, goes way back, goes back to antebellum slave patrols, when the police in the South, at least, which distinguished from Northern police, who were sort of a more watchman-style police that was imported from Europe, where the police were volunteers. They kept the peace. They patrolled at night to make sure there were no fires and to make sure children were in bed by curfew. That was sort of the Northern model. The Southern model were vigilante or hired police, hired by plantation owners to keep slaves in line and to usurp insurrection. I think that there's some indication that while that's a tad controversial, like there's still some ingrained systemic bias in that regard left over from, you know, from that mindset. We look at the uniform crime reports, which are submitted by each municipality, each police department to the FBI and kept in a big way by the FBI. And you can see that the arrest, not conviction, but the arrest rate for African Americans it tends to be proportionally higher compared with population for the offense of violent crimes. Which is interesting and sort of in contrast with the findings that we found about people being shot by police, because you're more likely to be shot by police in the commission of a violent crime in Florida if you're white. So there are a lot. I mean, the numbers show us a lot of really interesting things.
There's a narrative put out by some that police are hunting black people. Did you find any sort of evidence of that in your reporting?
No. In fact, you know, the handful of and it's fewer than five murders among police in the 6 years that we looked at were typically domestic issues. A man who happens to be a police officer is off duty, has a fight with his wife and kills her. In one case, a female detention deputy shot her either husband or a strange boyfriend. Those were criminal acts, and they were dealt with criminally. Those were also off-duty officers. Among the on-duty shootings that we looked at, 827, there were no cases, so far as I could find, where police like set out to murder somebody. These, by and large, were shootings that happened in the spur of the moment. They weren't planned. They were police responding in chaotic situations, or situations they perceived as being chaotic and dangerous to what they perceived as an immediate threat.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of this, too, is I've seen police are under a lot of scrutiny mm-hmm. today within the past, and probably rightfully so, because a lot of these things we have with the Internet, we can get these videos right away, and we have them, where I don't think it's changing where it's getting worse. I think it's probably getting better, but we have more access to this information, so we're seeing all this thrown in our face. So it seems like it's a bigger problem than it probably is, and it's getting better. I wonder how much of it is in any operation there's going to be user error, you know, just it was an accident.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if those, it's maybe showing those more frequently and showing that it's a bigger problem.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that the immediacy of technology today has an effect on how frequently we come into contact with stories like these. And they're not necessarily stories, they're videos. I mean, we're watching police kill people because we now carry in our pockets the ability to videotape and sometimes live broadcast anything. And so you see what you saw with the shooting of Philandro Castile, for instance, who was a legal gun owner stopped outside of Minneapolis, right? Maybe a year ago, and he tells the officer, "I have a gun. I have a concealed carry permit. I'm going to get my wallet," and he gets shot there and bleeds to death on Facebook Live.
Yeah.
If I'm correct about that. Mm-hmm. So that combined with the the increasing calls for the dash cam videos and the body cam videos and the wide public availability of those videos bring us into contact with those moments more than we ever have been in the past. And this is why we went after the numbers, because it seemed to me in 2014 that we're seeing those things more. And even since then, it's almost like they pick up in terms of frequency with the shooting of Tamir Rice and the gentleman who was running away from police in North Carolina. You just see them and you're outraged by them, but you don't know how to react because you don't know where to place them in context.
That's the thing with video too, because you have video. I got it on video, but there's stuff that happened before the video that maybe was not captured. Right. So you can't even rely on that entirely.
Right. Yeah, and so what we do in this project is use the police report to try to set these things up, to try to also categorize them based on the behavior, based on preceding incidents. Was the person in the commission of a violent crime, for instance? And if so, then that shooting automatically goes into a category. Did this involve an undercover drug investigation? Did it involve the SWAT team? So that we give readers a picture, or anybody who wants to access the database, a picture of the preceding events that led to the use of deadly force.
I noticed too that it seems like a lot of these ones that are more public in the public eye. The Michael Brown was a big one, I guess, because he was a kid. Tamir Rice. I don't remember being as big as Michael Brown was.
No, he was 12.
Yeah, well, I mean,
oh,
like as big of a story.
Yeah, right.
But the North Carolina shooting, I think, was a perfect example. I saw the video, and he shot the guy in the back, and that would have been a perfect example for people to use to prove their point. But they use these stories of Michael Brown, where it seems that, from all evidence that's been provided, he punched the cop and tried to grab his gun.
Right.
And there was a narrative that he begged for his life, and the cop just cold-blooded murdered him, which sounds insane. And what I found with news stories now is it sounds crazy. It probably is crazy.
Right.
But why do you think that people latch on to these stories like they do and then disregard ones where there's blatant blame to be placed?
I think you're right about that, and you can still actually talk about this in my story, but you still see people carrying signs at shooting protests that say, "Hands up, don't shoot," which is this false narrative that came out of the Michael Brown shooting. Now, there are plenty of shootings where people have their hands up and wind up getting shot, but that wasn't one. And two investigations by the Department of Justice show that that wasn't the case in that shooting. Officer Darrell Wilson had been punched. Michael Brown had at least reached into his car. There was a physical confrontation that preceded the use of deadly force. Why do people create or propagate false narratives around these shootings? I don't know. You probably have to ask a sociologist that question. I think it for many people, it probably justifies the sense of historic racial injustice. It gives them what they perceive at the time to be confirmation that their position on the injustice of police shootings is confirmed, and And then it takes on a life of its own. It becomes a hashtag, and it becomes something that people carry around on placards and shout into bullhorns. And it would take a genuinely curious person to read the full DOJ report, which I have, and determine, wait a minute, this isn't correct. We should stop shouting this. We should stop using this as a touchstone for the narrative. And that's not to say that I believe the shooting of Michael Brown was justified. The law says it is, and that's a separate issue, an interesting issue as well. The Supreme Court case law that established what is objectively reasonable when it comes to the use of restraint and the violation of the Fourth Amendment. I think it's just clear these things take on a life of their own, and they're hard to dispel, you know?
Yeah. Ben Montgomery from Tampa Bay Times is here on the Homemade Broadcast this week. I wonder with this type of stuff that's happening, MSNBC, you know, some of their talking heads, I understand they're not necessarily news people. A lot of them are opinion people. But they go on air and hold up their hands. This was Sally Cohn and a couple other people. Propagate this nonsense. And what should be the penalty for journalism that's just wrong? In your eyes?
I think it's a little... I think it's tough to say. You're asking my opinion, and I'm sort of paid not to give my opinion. But,
here you can.
Yeah, it's certainly a fair question. You know, I think ratings speak louder than anything. If people aren't tuning in to news stations that do a poor job of telling the truth, those news stations will soon fail to exist.
It's hard to decipher. It's really, because I'll go to look stuff up. This has been a big thing that I've been thinking about for the past few years. How do you know what's true anymore? There was a time where you relied on reporters to go to the presidential whatever press briefing, mm-hmm. and then they reported it back to you in the newspaper. Now I can just go watch on YouTube. That's obsolete at this point, and I can take from it whatever I want, which I think is a good thing. But there's also, I feel like reporters now, it is all opinion because those things are obsolete. You can go find any information you want. So I feel like news is just opinion. So when I read these things, I'll go find another source and it says something completely different. The opposite, even.
Yeah. So I think your task as a citizen is to determine which sources you find credible and which you don't. And, and how do you do that? You weigh everything involved. The Tampa Bay Times has been around for 125 years, and that's not because we are willy-nilly with the facts. If anybody corrects us, if we're factually incorrect, we run a correction on the front page of the newspaper, and that's an embarrassing thing for a reporter. I've been there. It's not something you ever want to have happen. If I get something wrong in a story, I can lose my job, and that's something I take very seriously. Is that the case at every website? Absolutely not, this is a society now where, in a big way, the legacy media, as it's often derisively called, the mainstream media has sort of lost its position as the gatekeeper of information. Before, you had, newspapers in your local community, and you had maybe three news stations on broadcast television. It was that way for several decades, and now things are incredibly diversified, and that's a good thing if you ask me. But it is has become more and more incumbent on the populace not to trust everything they read, but instead to explore the source, to determine the legitimacy of each and every source, and decide who you're going to trust. And I don't watch television news. not because I don't trust what I hear on television news. I just, it doesn't appeal to me because of what you said. Because often you have commentary upon the news, and they fill the time with that commentary. And it's not necessarily original reporting, and it's not necessarily ground on the, you know, boots on the ground reporting. It's people talking about what others have reported. And the truth is elusive in situations like that. In the instances of police shootings, the truth is incredibly elusive from the very beginning. And the few cases where it feels like you actually get a solid picture of what really happened in these chaotic moments are the cases that have run their full course, the cases that have started with a shooting and eventually wind up going through civil court, where you have everybody who was involved or everybody who witnessed subjected to depositions, often hours long, lengthy depositions. You have every bit of evidence, you know, from videotapes to crime scene photographs to ballistics to forensics. All of that is entered into the public record. And then you're able to weigh all of this stuff and determine where the true narrative lies. When in the beginning of that, you may have only gotten a press release with the police version of events that went down. So, you know, these are complicated things. And like I said, the true story is often elusive.
Were you able during this story to talk to any officers that were involved in these shootings?
Not involved in these shootings, because often it's the case that officers are sued in civil court. And so they're prevented from talking with the fear that they might say something that harms their defense.
That's a shame, because yeah. I think that would, if they had some sort of, maybe not even an officer themselves, but the chief or something to come out and just talk honestly with the media and be like, look, you know, I don't know, whatever, you can make up whatever story you want, but just seem like it's not just a robot, you know, talking, a spokesman that's just, but to talk like a real person talks.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that would do so much more to kind of help heal these things.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, the one, when I talked to police chiefs across the state, the one fellow that we wound up spending a lot of time with was a guy named Mike Chitwood, who is the police chief in Daytona Beach, was the police chief in Daytona Beach. He's now the sheriff of Volusia County. And Chitwood came up in the through the ranks in the Philadelphia Police Department, 18 years, had two shootings. He said, you know, thank God both of them were guys who were armed. So they were what police call good shoots. But the, you know, he's now running Volusia County Sheriff's Office. And he has some, he's like a straight talker, you know, he's got some interesting ideas and theories about how to police less violently and how to shape policy in a way that tries to preserve the sanctity of human life. He has a lot of experience in dealing with, the systemic difficulties of, policing high crime areas and changing culture inside of police departments.
What were some of the examples that he gave you of doing that? Can you recall?
Yeah, sure. I'm starting with hiring. He wants to hire the right people, and that's often a difficult thing. You sometimes look at a person's CV and they want to join your police force, and you take it at face value, and it turns out the person is not who you hired or not what they look like on paper. And he gave an example of this. This guy, he said he looked like he had a great history. He had some time in the military, which Chitwood liked, because they're often used to tense situations, and they play it, and they're cooler under pressure. And the guy's resume looked great. Chitwood hired a background investigator to go deeper than they had asked for in the documents spelling out the person's history, and he found the guy had been convicted of I can't remember if it was murder or manslaughter, but had been involved in a violent crime in like the state of Washington, and that didn't show up on whatever cursory background investigation they had done at first. It actually took somebody going.
Really? how did that work?
Well, I guess it was expunged or it was sealed or something like that. This is what my wife does for the military. But, yeah, it's not rare necessarily that you can hide you can hide a crime like that. So starting with hiring, and then he wants the police force to look like the community. So in the case of Daytona Beach, he said, you know, it seems like we're not representing the black community in our police force like we should be. And so he started recruiting directly from Bethune-Cookman College, which is a historically black university, until he got the numbers right, where it felt like, the, you know, our police force racially looks like the community that they're representing. Was the first police agency in the state of Florida to require body cameras. All the cops started wearing body cameras, and he had trepidation about that. He said, look, a lot of times it dispels the myths. If something bad happens and the community is outraged by it, they can see that video and see, oh, we made the wrong judgment. This guy actually deserved to get shot or whatever. So that's part of it. But the other side is, as a police administrator, you have to be aware of the fact that your cops are going to be caught taking inappropriate actions sometimes, and you're going to have to face the criticism for that, especially because body cam videos are public record in Florida, so we can see whatever we ask for, the public can. And then he started, you know, interestingly, he started videotaping or audio recording everything inside of the police station. And he did this because, there were some shenanigans in, like, interrogation rooms when police would bring people in and have them, set them up during interrogations. And so he wanted to see everything that was going on. He said this is helpful because you can see if the shenanigans are going down. And then, at the flip side, you can get the conversations between defendants maybe making a phone call and telling others that they're guilty of the crime or what have you. So it works both ways. And then we can talk about this if you're interested, but he put in place a set of policies intentionally aimed at curbing the use of deadly force.
Well, and what is that?
Well, it's, it starts with shaping our policies to preserve the sanctity of human life, and that sounds kind of hoity-toity, but how can we police, what policies can we put in place to protect the people that we're arresting, ultimately the people that we're serving? And so it includes things like, his guys will never fire into a vehicle. I mean, this is what he says. Whether it happens or not is another question. But, he said, if you're going to shoot into a car, you better have tire marks on your chest. And his thinking behind that is, if you shoot a driver, you're creating an unguided 3,000-pound missile that could potentially hurt other people. So there's no need. Somebody's trying to speed away from you, let them go. We'll catch up to them. You know, we got their license plate. We got the car description. We can follow them down the road, whatever. Let's not put other people in harm's way. He talks a lot about proportionality. His line is, would you use an elephant gun to kill a flea? No. So maybe a guy's got a knife and showed us video of this that shows kind of the prime example of how a couple of rookie officers took down a deranged man who was wielding a knife and coming at them with a knife. One cop has his gun drawn. The other cop has his taser. And the cop with the taser starts calling the guy by the first name because he recognizes him from his patrol work. Derek, drop the knife. What are you doing, Derek? Calm down, Derek. Trying to de-escalate the situation.
Yeah.
We got video on TampaBay.com. And he winds up, the guy gets within 10 feet or so, and he says, taser, taser, and pops him with the taser. And the guy goes down, kicked the knife out of his hand, and they make an arrest. And a few days later, Chitwood said he was riding through the neighborhood, and Derek is back on his meds out of jail. And he says, hey, Chitwood, how you doing, man? And Chitwood says, you came real close to getting shot and killed. So proportionality, using the right amount of force in the right circumstance. And then he teaches guys to create time and distance. Don't rush into situations. Don't put yourself in harm's way. If you can use an object to avoid confrontation, physical confrontation with a person who might be deranged or mentally ill or whatever, if you can run around your vehicle and get out of harm's way, there's nothing shameful in that. Before you use deadly force. And he anecdotally has a good example of this. He was working bike week in 2012, and he's walking down Main Street, and he's wearing shorts and a 3-button polo. And this guy comes up, and he's clearly drunk. Bike Week is like 500,000 bikers, you know. Mm-hmm. This guy's clearly drunk, and he tells Chitwood that he's a sovereign citizen and that the police have no authority over him. And Chitwood thinks, you know, this guy's just drunk. I'm going to let him go. And so he turns around and starts to walk away, and the guy spits on the chief's back. Chitwood says, all right, you got to go to jail now. So he starts to try to take the guy, put the guy under arrest, cuff him. The guy resists, and they wind up in a physical confrontation. Fall to the ground hard enough that Chitwood hits his head on a motorcycle fender and has to get stitches later. But they fall to the ground. The guy's on top of Chitwood, and Chitwood winds up with his right index finger in the guy's mouth, and the guy's biting it off. Chitwood's got his, he's a lefty, he's got his gun on his left hip. Rather than go for this gun, and he said he had this thought in the moment, rather than go for his gun, his assailant who's on top of him, biting his finger off, Chitwood just starts punching him in the head with his left hand, hard enough to break four bones in his left hand. And he says, you know what, I'm not, this is after the fact, he's not necessarily bragging about this, we kind of had to pull it out of him, but he said, I'm not going to be known as a police chief who shoots somebody dead on Main Street in Daytona Beach during Bike Fest, Bike Week. He said, I'd rather be known as the police chief who lost his finger to a crazy guy in Bike Week. And he wound up getting a cast, his finger was intact, and he went back to work later that day, and a guy went to jail. He uses this as an example to say, you know, proportionality works. If you're, I think all of us, especially if you have any history in examining police shootings in Florida, nobody would have batted an eye if the police chief shot a guy dead who was trying to bite his finger off and who had, you know, tackled him to the ground and was engaged in trying to hurt him. He didn't do that. And as a result, you know, ultimately everybody was safe and a criminal went to jail.
Yeah, Ben Montgomery, it's a nuanced issue. I don't know if there's any, you know, I'm glad we have this data now to at least have it to look at, and hopefully it results in some sort of betterment of policing, and hopefully responsibility maybe taken more by citizens, too. So thank you for coming on, and where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, thank you, Will, for having me. Let me just make the point. I think ultimately the thing I'd like to see come out of this, you know, people ought to keep count. We ought to have some central repository for these kinds of records. Somebody needs to be able to say at any given point in time, this is how many times this year that the Florida police, the police across the nation mm-hmm. have shot somebody. I think it's just at a bare minimum that important.
Just to have the data.
Just to have the data so we can see if it's a problem or not. You can find me at, find the story at tampabay.com. Find me at, at Gangrey on Twitter, at Gangrey, and B. Montgomery at TampaBay.com is my email.
All right, there you go, Ben Montgomery, Tampa Bay Times. Make sure you check out that story. Interesting stuff. I wish I had longer with them, but hopefully he'll be back again soon. Thank you, Ben. Stay tuned. If you listen on Radio St. Pete, we got Frank Rivera's jazz show coming right from his home here in Seminole, Florida. And the Indie Circuit comes up after that. And if you listen on podcast, hey, thanks. Make sure you rate and subscribe. It only takes a minute. Really helps us out. HMBradio.com. See you next week.